Before we get into today's show, I have some urgent news to share with you. Premier Insight's financial year ends on June 30th, and it's vital we close a final funding gap of $65,000 by that date. The great news is a generous friend of the ministry has offered to match the first $10,000 given to help jumpstart giving towards this goal. But we must fully meet the $10,000 for it to be released. That's why I wanted to take a moment before we get into today's podcast to ask for your help. If you would, please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we get into today's show, I have some urgent news to share with you. Premier Insight's financial year ends on June 30th, and it's vital we close a final funding gap of $65,000 by that date. The great news is a generous friend of the ministry has offered to match the first $10,000 given to help jumpstart giving towards this goal. But we must fully meet the $10,000 for it to be released. That's why I wanted to take a moment before we get into today's podcast to ask for your help. If you would, please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome along to the programme this Saturday afternoon. Just about halfway through June now, aren't we? The year is flying past. I'm Justin Briley and I'm with you through till 4 o'clock as we look at another discussion between a Christian and a non-Christian here on the programme. It's unbelievable. And of course, later on in the day, we're going to hear from Dave and Bea. They'll be here with Hip Rock UK and of course, Loretta Fenton presents Unsigned Christian Music Talent from 6 p.m. this evening. That's all to come. Right now, let me tell you what's coming up on today's programme here on Unbelievable. You're unbelievable. Going to be meeting a very well-versed man. He is an incredibly intelligent man as well, Keith Ward. He's the former Oxford Regius Professor of Divinity, and he has been made a lifelong study, really, of philosophy. And he's a committed Christian, and he brings that to his study of philosophy. Well, he's written a book called The Big Questions in Science and Religion, and we're really going to be tackling a central theme of that, which is evolution and creation. Can you sort of marry them together? Because Keith does believe in evolution. He is what you might call a theistic evolutionist, and he's going to be explaining why he doesn't see that there's a contradiction with a creator God. Against that will be atheist scientist Robert Stovold. It's all to come here on the programme. And let me tell you now that Keith's book, The Big Questions in Science and Religion, which covers all manner of topics, this is just one chapter really that we're focusing on from the book, that book available at the Premier Shop, premier.org.uk/shop, The Big Questions in Science and Religion. So we'll be meeting our guests, Keith Ward, Oxford professor, and Robert Stovold, atheist scientist, very shortly. Let's get a look at some of the response to a couple of weeks of programming, though. First of all, it's still going on. Emails coming in regarding the Lakeland outpouring, the Florida outpouring with Todd Bentley. It's certainly something that's got a lot of Christians interested. And we did that program about a month back now, still getting responses to it. This one from Barbara says, I've just listened to the program with Gerald Coates, Mark Johnston and Stephen Pilcher. My husband and I spent 8 days at the Lakeland outpouring at the end of May. I wish to say some things. Mark said, Mark, you may remember, was our cessationist minister, i.e. doesn't believe in the charismatic gifts of the Holy Spirit for today. He said he hadn't heard of anyone whose response to Lakeland is repentance. Well, my personal response to the first evening meeting was, oh, woe is me. The following morning, I went to the Ignite Church, and again, woe is me. This was my reaction to every single meeting during 8 days. It continues to be my response now that I'm back in England and processing all that I saw and heard and felt happening to me in Florida. The most traceable change in my life is that I'm desperate to change the way I live. I always thought of myself as someone who prayed. All I can do is cry out to God over my prayerlessness. My husband and I have set our hearts to pray 3 hours per day because we see in new ways the waste of human efforts that have characterised so much of what we do. Obviously, you had quite an amazing experience there. Barbara, sorry, I can't read all your email. I'll just sort of maybe read out one or two bits from the end. You say, I would like to refer you to the website of Todd's ministry, freshfire.ca, to read the letter by Todd defending the revival, and also the 55-page theological paper by Dr. Gary S. Grieg, PhD. Finally, if you would like to, I would like to have asked both Stephen and Mark Johnston. Stephen was our agnostic on that programme. If God is really like this, and if he is a God who looks upon the human suffering from disease, accidents, birth defects, etc., and he decides he simply must pour out his grace in a wonderful way, is that okay with you? Would you be happy for him to be this kind of a God? His word says he will have mercy on whoever he wishes. May he do this? Would this kind of God be a disappointment to you, or would you be proud of him as I am? Thank you, Barbara, for your email on the Florida Outpouring. And if you're interested, Christianity Magazine is really focusing on that revival in their July edition, which I think is hitting the bookstores about now. So it's worth checking that out as well. Angels. A couple of weeks ago, we had Lorna Byrne with her experiences of interacting with angels, and we were asking, are Lorna's experiences, do they match up with the Bible? Do they really glorify Jesus? John Chittery says, listening to Lorna speaking about her experiences with angels, it occurred to me that the rest of us who don't have such encounters must learn something from them. What, for instance, are we to make of the incidents she reported of the Lord Jesus holding back the dark angels and that she was giving a helping hand, but only after he had touched her fingers? Such things are not like dreams. She's clearly no dreamer, but they taught her something, and she has passed on the lesson in her description without any embellishment. In my mind, it suggests that the Lord Jesus fights on our behalf, and this is, of course, a well known amongst Christians. So much for my explanation, but I think Lorna's telling of it was far better and contained many lessons for us. So John, obviously, very much in favour of Lorna's very unusual claims about daily interaction with angels. Oriana, or Anna Prenger, on the other hand, very much the critic of Lorna's experiences. You say, Lorna Byrne highlights once more my concerns about Catholics and their beliefs and practices. She is totally deceived by her angelic experience, and she makes it clear for anyone who has ears to hear that she does not know Jesus as her Lord and Saviour at all. Talking about God and not giving importance to Jesus is completely wrong, and the two cannot stand together. God cannot deny himself. The whole Bible is written with the blood of Jesus, and he is the highlight of the Bible and of Christianity. She spoke about her Christianity only from memories or practices of the past. She did not speak of a personal encounter with Jesus because she does not know him, you say, Anna. Thank you very much for your emails. Obviously, different reactions to that programme. Do check it out on our webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. That was of a couple of weeks ago, that programme, the one on angels with Lorna Byrne and Faith Forster, who was our Christian guest as well in the studio. premier.org.uk/unbelievable. All right, let's get some calls in on the phone lines, see what people have been having to say in the last couple of weeks. This one, quite unusual. Don't often get these sorts of calls, but I wanted to play this one.
Hi, my name is Gail, and so many bad things have happened to me in my life, right? I really don't believe in God. If there was a God, you know, so many people would be dying of cancer, and bad things will, you know, wouldn't keep happening, okay? I've had so many bad things in my life, right, that if there was a God, it wouldn't have happened. Children and everything. I'll tell you what, it's a farce.
Thank you, Gail, for calling in. Now, is it a farce? Is God a farce? I mean, I would say no, and I'd love to get in contact with you. In fact, I'm going to get in contact with you, Gail, and see if we can maybe bring you in and have a conversation with you about this feeling that, you know, we just can't understand how God can exist given the suffering that exists in the world. And I'm sure it's a topic we're going to do again soon in the future. So I hope that we can help in some way to help you to see that as well. I truly believe that we do have a God who exists. And even though we see suffering in the world around us, he's still loving, he's still working, he's still acting in ways maybe that we can't grasp very easily at first sight. More of your phone responses now. This in particular in regard to last week. This one from Tunde on contradictions in the Bible. Now, we had with us last week Stephen Pilcher, again coming in as our sort of agnostic sceptic. He was putting what appeared to be Bible contradictions to Alex McFarland of the Southern Evangelical Seminary in North Carolina. And that was a very interesting programme. Again, it's available on the webpage. Here's what Tunde wanted to say about a contradiction, supposed contradiction, Stephen brought up from Proverbs.
Hello, my name is Tunde. I'm calling with regards to the contradiction, supposed contradiction in Proverbs chapter 26 from verse 4. First of all, before I go ahead with that, I would like to applaud the gentleman from the U.S., Alex. He did a good job in answering and debunking all the contradictions, quote-unquote, of Stephen. When he says, answer not a fool according to his folly, lest thou also be like him. And verse 5 says, answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. It's just saying, apply wisdom. You know, if you answer a fool at a certain time, you just become a fool like him. If you're arguing with a fool, in the heat of anger, you get angry with the same kind of passion. Nobody even knows who's right or wrong, who is logical and who is foolish. At that time, you might just need to be quiet. But there's a time where you need to speak up also, so that the person, so you're actually saving the fool from his folly, so that the person will not think this is the right thing to do. You actually have to speak up. It means there's a time to be quiet and there's a time to speak. That's my contribution. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Tunde. Completely different sort of topic that reared its head as well. I don't quite know where this came from, but this is what David picked up from the programme. Let's hear this message.
Hello, this is David Greenwood from Manchester. I was listening in to Unbelievable on Saturday, 14th of June, and I did hear somebody talking about the Christians meeting on a Sunday. And the impression I got was that it was being suggested that Christians should no longer meet on a Saturday. Well, I believe that, in fact, Saturday is still a Sabbath and always has been, and that early Christians, including the apostles, would refer to Saturday as the Sabbath day even after Pentecost. That's what I believe. Now, I don't judge people by how they spend their Saturdays, because I don't believe that that's right, but I still believe that it is the right of people to consider the Saturday the Sabbath. Thank you.
Well, maybe we'll get a time for a discussion on that big topic another time, David. I know it's obviously something that whole denominations have been formed over, whether we worship on the Saturday or the Sunday. But not today. We're not going to be able to get into that today, so we'll have to wait maybe for another time for that. Thanks for all your emails. Let me remind you again, if you want to get in touch during the course of today's programme, the email address is unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and you can phone 08456 52 52 52. To leave me a voicemail message. Now, if you did miss last week's programme on Bible contradictions, do get online, premier.org.uk/unbelievable, and you can listen back to the programme there. Okay, time for the second in our regular new slot from John Twistleton. John, each week, is tackling a frequently asked question, in particular, looking at whether we can really believe in Christianity in this week's edition.
Frequently Asked Questions with John Twistleton.
Isn't Christianity just made up, they ask? An Italian atheist took his parish priest to court for teaching the existence of Jesus, and the judge refused to rule. Truth is, you can't prove 100% that anyone existed. Anyone who's not alive to prove it. Actually, Jesus is alive, and he's made his case over 20 centuries, but that doesn't quite answer the question. To say Christianity is made up is to write off a lot of historical evidence. The difficulty is that so much of that evidence is in Christian documents. Not all of it. There are clear references to Jesus in first century writers. Take Roman historian Tacitus. He writes that when Rome burned down in 64 AD, the Emperor Nero fastened the guilt on a class hated for their abominations called Christians. Christus, from whom the name had its origins, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of Pontius Pilate. Tacitus confirms from his ancient history what Christians recite Sunday by Sunday in their creed. Scripture scholar and Bishop Tom Wright says it would be easier, frankly, to believe that Tiberius Caesar, Jesus' contemporary, was a figment of the imagination than to believe that there was never such a person as Jesus. Trouble is, you can see Tiberius's face on a coin, but you can't see Jesus's. That's the way history goes. A Galilean carpenter wouldn't, in the normal run of things, leave the same mark on history as the Emperor of Rome. If someone says to me Christianity's made up, I'd point them patiently to the solid witness of the New Testament backed up by other first century writings. At the heart of the New Testament is the story of Jesus who taught, healed, suffered and died in the name of his God. The astonishing part of this history is the record of his resurrection and the galvanizing of his followers through the Holy Spirit. They said Christianity was made up right from the beginning. Saul of Tarsus said so, but got stopped in his tracks on the way to Damascus by a heavenly light. The earliest historical evidence for Christianity actually lies in the letters of St. Paul. These date from around 50 AD, only 20 years after Jesus is said to have died and risen. Millions today have read former atheist Lee Strobel's book, The Case for Christ. Strobel, a journalist and law student, attempted a rigorous investigation of the evidence for Jesus. He ended up a Christian. He was impressed by the accounts of the resurrection appearances of Jesus. Strobel considered them to be as well authenticated as anything in history. Discrepancies between the accounts, the number and placing of angels, who was first at the scene, where Christ appeared and so on, actually provide a ring of truth. These variations are consistent with the recording of a stupendous event. Any serious attempt to make up the resurrection stories would have made a better job of it. When people say Christianity is made up, we've got to point them to the facts as best we can. That doesn't mean we shouldn't question their motivation. If you want to deny Christ's teaching, it's natural to have a go at denying his existence, in the hope of undermining what he stands for. Can you really undermine Christ's teaching like this? Mahatma Gandhi said of the Sermon on the Mount, it would be true even if Christ had never existed. Is Christianity just made up? If it's not, it's the best news of all. Atheist newspaper columnist Matthew Paris has said that if he came to believe it, he'd spend his whole life letting people know about it. Those who have encountered the risen Jesus over 20 centuries prove his point. How could so many have died as Christian martyrs for what they saw as at best a half-truth? The experience of the living Christ by Christians is at the heart of the survival of Christianity for 2,000 years. All the armies that ever marched, all the navies that ever sailed, all the parliaments that ever sat, all the kings that ever reigned, put together, have not affected the life of man on this earth as much as this one solitary life. The name of Jesus is not so much written as ploughed into the history of the world.
If you have any difficult questions about the Christian faith or have your own answer for the frequently asked question we looked at today, please visit www.premier.org.uk/FAQ to contribute to the programme.
And my thanks, as usual, to John Twistleton. He'll be back again with another frequently asked question at the same time next week. Well, we're going to meet our guest now. It's time we looked at the big questions in science and religion.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
And time to introduce our guests on the programme this afternoon. Joining me, Keith Ward. Keith is an eminent philosopher and was until recently the Regius Professor of Divinity at Oxford University. I'm sure he'll explain exactly what that means soon. He's also an ordained priest in the Church of England and has written many books defending the existence of God from a philosophical point of view. So we're very privileged to have him with us on the programme today. His new book is titled The Big Questions in Science and Religion. It's published by Templeton Press, and it will give you an idea of how you can get hold of that if you're interested in it a little bit later in the programme. Also with us, if you like, on the opposing side is Robert Stovall. Robert is an atheist scientist. He's been with us before, so you may recognise his voice. And he has a background in evolutionary biology. He's a member of the National Secular Society. So, gentlemen, thank you both for joining me on the programme today.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks.
Great to be with you. Firstly, Keith, you are resident in Oxford. And you've been there. Is it ever since you were appointed to this particular position?
Yes, that's about 16 years.
You recently retired from it, but what did it actually involve? What does the Regius Professor of Divinity do?
Well, divinity is just another word for theology, really. So what you do is you look at Christian beliefs. And also, I specialised in looking at other beliefs as well, Hindu, Buddhist, etc. So I look at these beliefs and you ask where they came from, you look at the languages they were written in and say what their relevance is for today. So we're pretty free to do what we like. We have to teach students, of course, and they have to get through their exams, so there is a syllabus. But in general, what I specialised in was the relation of modern religious discoveries to ancient religious... what I specialise in is the relation of modern scientific discoveries to ancient religious traditions
and see
just how they relate to one another.
And that's very much the theme of the book that we're looking at today.
It is.
But what about personally? Has your belief in God as a Christian always been part of your life?
I'm a convert, no, so I was an atheist. Philosophers in my day, when I was younger, more or less had to be atheists. You had to sign up to not believing anything. But I think that was a phase. A lot of philosophers have changed. I became a Christian, but partly through philosophy, actually, partly through looking at discussions about God and about the soul or the mind and so on, and whether there's purpose in the universe. And I began to take Christianity seriously as a possible answer to some of these questions. So that helped. But actually, in the end, I became a Christian, as a lot of converts do, through personal experience, really, believing that I'd encountered God in the person of Christ. So the personal experience was very important. But the intellectual bit had to make sense for me as well.
And obviously that's something you've spent a lot of your life looking into, is the correlation between the philosophy and belief in God, belief in, if you like, something more than just the materialism that often people want to, well, certain people at least today want to have us believe is the only thing that exists. And you also ordained in the Church of England. When did that happen and what drew you to do that?
Well, that was when I was a lecturer in philosophy at King's College in London. And I suppose because most philosophers were atheists, partly because of that reason, I thought being ordained would be a mark of commitment to something, give people a surprise, you know. And so I was ordained as what's called a non-stipendiary minister. It means you don't get paid, you don't have a parish, but you function as a minister and you help out in parishes where you live. I've always done that. That point of surprising people by believing was a bit lost when I became a professor of theology, but anyway, that was the original idea.
Well, it's a great privilege to have you on the programme today, so thank you for being with us. And we're going to be looking, as I say, at Keith's book, The Big Questions in Science and Religion. I'm only really skirting over a couple of the issues mentioned in the book. Certainly, if you want to get a fuller picture of what's in there, I do urge you to go and get a copy of it yourself, and you can do that via the Premier shop. That's premier.org.uk/shop. The book itself published by Templeton Press, and I'm sure it's available in Christian bookstores as well. But our other guest on the programme today is Robert Stovold, as I mentioned earlier, and Robert joining us again. Robert, your particular interest, of course, is science, biology, etc. That's what you, as it were, trained in.
Yes, that's right.
But you're an atheist, and that's always... Has that been something which has been a part of your life for as long as you can remember?
Well, like everyone, I was born an atheist, that is to say, lacking a belief in God.
Mm-hmm.
I think I went through... when I was younger, went through life being very interested in the natural world and learning about how that worked, scientific explanations for how that worked. But it was only later, I think at about the time I went to university, that I began to think one way or the other, really, about religion. It had always been there in the past, as I knew other people believed in, for example, some people took the Bible literally, and they would believe that the story of Adam and Eve, that the world was about 6,000 to 10,000 years old. I never really sort of took to it. It always seemed rather sort of fantastic to me, and I thought, well, I'll just go along with this evolution thing. Seems to make a lot more sense. But it wasn't until I went to university that I really began to understand the power of evolutionary theory. And I think it's something we'll probably come back to when we discuss perhaps the rise of new atheism, if you like.
I was going to say,
of Richard Dawkins.
Obviously, for you, evolution really cemented, if you like, your atheism, because you felt that it really excluded any need for belief in any kind of creator.
That's true, although if you ask what actually motivates my atheism, motivates me to, for example, come on a Christian radio show like this, I think it was my encounter with the Jehovah's Witnesses, because they produced a book called Life, How Did It Get Here? By Creation or Evolution, which contains a huge pack of falsehoods. I mean, I'm sure that the people distributing that book, I suspect many of them are very sincere and they sincerely believe what's written in that book. But if you look at the things in that book and trace it back and look at what the original scientists actually said, you can see the book misquotes them terribly. So the knowledge that religion or some religious people were actively distorting what scientists believe, it led me to see a lot of religious people as being victims of that propaganda. And that's one thing that really kind of motivates me, really.
Well, we'll get into this. I think this is a great starting point for the discussion we're about to launch into. And if you're listening, let me tell you that this program will be here until 4 o'clock this afternoon. And we're going to be looking at this whole area, first of all, of science and religion, in particular in regard to evolution and creation. And we're going to hear exactly where Keith stands in that particular debate. Obviously, we've heard something of where Robert is on that. And we'd love to hear from you as well. So don't forget that you can get in touch. You can leave us your thoughts by email. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Or you can leave me a voicemail message, and I'm happy to play that out on next week's programme, and indeed send any relevant ones on to our guests. The number for that, 08456 52 52 52, and select option 5.
I just wanted to quickly remind you that Premier Insight has been offered a $10,000 matching grant that will double your gift today. And right now, that's an incredible blessing, as we're needing $65,000 before the end of the financial year on June 30th. This show depends on the generosity of friends like you. So I'm asking you to give your very best gift right now to meet this $65,000 need, knowing your gift will be doubled. You can give now at premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you. I just wanted to quickly remind you that Premier Insight has been offered a $10,000 matching grant that will double your gift today. And right now, that's an incredible blessing, as we're needing $65,000 before the end of the financial year on June 30th. This show depends on the generosity of friends like you. So I'm asking you to give your very best gift right now to meet this $65,000 need, knowing your gift will be doubled. You can give now at premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you.
Join us again in just a couple of moments' time.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Yes, this is the programme where Christians and non-Christians come together to discuss their different beliefs and to explain why they find the other person's views unbelievable, as the programme title suggests. Well, privileged to have in the studio today Keith Ward. He's an eminent philosopher, until recently the Regius Professor of Divinity at Oxford University, and he's ordained in the Church of England. And he's really spent much of his life defending the existence of God from a philosophical point of view. And we're looking today at his new book, The Big Questions in Science and Religion. It's published by Templeton Press. And to help us to look at that with his own critical eye is Robert Stovold. Robert is an atheist scientist with a background in evolutionary biology, and he certainly feels that there is no place for religious belief in a scientific age. We're going to be finding out how that relates to evolution and belief in creation. That's coming up in this section of the programme. We'll also be looking at the subject of whether religious belief can count as evidence in a scientific age. All to come here on the programme, where Christians and non-Christians talk. Now, obviously, there is a wide range of theological belief in Christianity, Keith, and I know many of our listeners correspond to different parts of that spectrum, and many would want to say, I believe wholeheartedly that the Bible is literally true from Genesis 1 onwards. It all happened just like it's laid down. Others would say, no, we must take the Genesis account as a story of why, if you like, God set certain things in motion, not a how, not a kind of science textbook. And I, from what I can gather, you probably would subscribe to what might be called a theistic evolution sort of point of view.
I'd be happy with that description. Yeah.
And so what do you say to those who would say, but surely that if the Bible is to be believed, it's to be believed as it's written, you know, that there was an Adam and an Eve in an original garden, and that if you actually trace back how many years ago that was, according to, you know, how many generations can be traced in the Bible, it was only 10,000 years ago. What do you say to those sorts of beliefs?
Well, I'm not against people believing that. I'm rather in favour of people trying out all sorts of different beliefs and being free to express them. But I do think it's important they don't misrepresent what scientists say. They've got to get the facts right, and if they're going to disagree with those facts, they've got to have some pretty good reasons for it. But going further back than that, the Bible itself, I mean, as a Christian minister, I believe that the Word of God is the person of Jesus Christ. As John's Gospel says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God. And that was Jesus Christ. That was Christ who became incarnate in the person of Jesus. And so the Word of God is not actually the words of the Bible. According to John's Gospel, it mm-hmm. is the person of Christ. Now, I think the Bible testifies, witnesses to Christ. But I personally don't think that the Bible is without error, or that I do think that a lot of it is definitely not literal. So, for example, when the Bible says God rides on the clouds, very few people think that God actually does ride on the clouds, or if he sits on a throne, he hasn't got legs and arms and sits on a throne, or if he walked in the Garden of Eden, he doesn't walk around looking for Adam, you know. So most Christians really would say we're not going to be literal all the way. We're going to say there's a lot of metaphor, and then the question is how far do you take the metaphor? Well, people like me, who are very committed Christians, would say you take the metaphor as far as you can. You look for the spiritual meaning. And you say a lot of the Bible is written in using big metaphors like the dragon of the deep being slain, or the Lamb of God in the book of Revelation with a sword in its mouth. You say, well, it's not actually a little thing going meh and somehow carrying a sword around. This is a symbol. So my general view would be, you know, given that I'm in favour of everybody thinking up their own opinions, freedom of thought, yes. Nevertheless, I think people should accept there's a lot of symbolism in the Bible. And then you work out, well, how much of it is symbolism? So, right, to cut a long story short, for me, the book of Genesis, the account of creation, is symbolism. It's very profound symbolism, but it is not meant to be literally true. So I think that's how I would take that.
And would you say, you know, as you see the history of Christian thought, that this is something that people have gone to since the evolutionary theory came about, that suddenly, you know, oh dear, here's a problem. We can no longer take the Bible literally because it appears science is telling us that evolutionary theory tells us that the Earth is millions of years old and humans only came into existence fairly recently, that therefore, if you like, people started to talk about taking these things symbolically because science had forced them into it.
No, I don't think that's true at all. I mean, St. Augustine, a very long time ago, wrote a book called On the Literal Interpretation of Genesis, but what he meant by literal was symbolic. The word has changed its meaning completely. And he explained that the days were not 24 hours long. I mean, that was a symbol for ages of time, could be millions of years. And of course, people like Augustine then in the early centuries didn't know anything about evolution at all. They'd never thought of that. But their view wasn't that you had a literal account in Genesis. In fact, literalism of the Genesis account only occurred after the rise of science, when scientists made the distinction between, you know, what you could photograph, what you could see if you were there, and spiritual truth. Right. So literalism is quite a new phenomenon.
Right.
It's almost entirely a 20th century American phenomenon, as a matter of fact, which originated in the 1920s and 30s in Chicago.
Obviously, Robert, the creationist movement, if we're going to, you know, brand it with a title, is something that you've long, you know, been an ardent critic of.
Yes.
And there are many forums on the web that where those sorts of debates go on. Mm-hmm. What's your line to someone like Keith, who, if you like, stands in this theistic evolution position where they believe in evolution,
yes. But
they believe that there's also a God, if you like, behind that process?
I think they're trying to have what they see as the kind of best of both worlds, you know, belief in God and also belief that's consistent with science, which is a very powerful way of understanding the world. But just because a belief is consistent with scientific evidence, this might sound like a strange thing for a scientist to say, but just because a belief is consistent with scientific evidence, that doesn't make it necessarily a reliable belief. Let me give you an example. One example of a religious belief in a sort of battle between religion and science that is consistent with science, but which no Christians or very few Christians believe anymore, is what's called the appearance of age hypothesis. That's the idea that the Earth really is 6,000 or 6,000 to 10,000 years old, but the devil made it look older by sort of placing fossils and fiddling radioisotope dates to make it look older. Now, the thing about that idea is it's actually perfectly consistent with the scientific evidence, because any scientific evidence a scientist can come up with, someone who believes in the appearance of age hypothesis can say, oh, well, the devil put that evidence there to trick you. So this here we have an idea which is consistent with the scientific evidence, but which most Christians today, I think, can see through as being incredibly contrived. And I think that theistic evolution suffers the same fate. It's just less obviously contrived. But you see, in the case of the devil planting false evidence, there are very sort of sound theological arguments for why he would do that. You know, the devil tempts people and misleads people. Stands to reason, doesn't it? From very early sort of theological principles, the devil's a liar, so that's why he's put all this false evidence there. And if Christians believe that, they can take the Bible fairly literally and also square it with Christian theology. But the thing about theistic evolution is you have to answer why God, who is allegedly a God of love, chooses a mechanism in evolution which necessarily entails the suffering of animals. It's, as Charles Darwin said, what a book a devil's chaplain might write on the cruel, blind, low and horridly cruel works of nature. It's the last mechanism you would expect a loving God to use.
That's interesting. I mean, and I'm sure, Keith, you would want to say that you agree with Robert that there are, you know, some hypotheses which are strained and incredulous in terms of, you know, the idea that the devil's been planting yeah. false evidence around, etc. But on the other hand, this is a specific argument you deal with in your book. Why would, if we do believe in evolution, why would a loving God, in the Christian view, use such a very wasteful process such as evolution, where millions of species, it's likely, have died out and you know, are no longer with us, seemingly random in a sense in the way it progresses? Yeah.
Well, I don't think that problem is made worse by evolution. I mean, because it's there anyway. Whether or not evolution happened, animals suffer, things die, species become extinct every day. Now, it's not something that happened in the far past. So the problem is the same, whether or not you believe in evolution. And the problem is very simply, why did God create a universe with so much suffering in it? Now, given that that's the problem, Christians have always admitted it's a huge problem, I think evolution makes it easier to suggest why God might have made the universe in that way, to contain suffering. It is, I think, just worth saying that evolution was a religious and philosophical theory before it was a scientific theory.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it was theologians in Germany in the 18th and 19th century who first developed a view of evolution. They were called German idealists, the best known is Hegel. but Herder was earlier than Hegel. And they developed a view on religious grounds. They were Lutheran Christians, and they developed a view that God was progressively revealing the divine being through a development of natural processes. They applied this to history mostly. They didn't have a scientific theory about evolution, but it was an evolutionary theory.
Right.
And in fact, Charles Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus, believed that, not as a scientific theory, but as a sort of progressive evolution theory. Everything was getting better and better. And in Darwin's own evolution, you know, The Origin of Species, you get traces of that. Every now and again, he will say, oh, we're all progressing towards perfection. But then he thinks, well, maybe we're not. Okay, but still, evolution was not primarily a scientific theory. It was, in the first place, it arose from thinking that God might be progressively bringing things about bit by bit.
But this presumably was a belief that there was a purpose, if you like, to that evolution.
Yeah.
And that's a big difference, I assume, between your view, Keith, and Robert's view. Because, Robert, you presumably believe in evolution being this blind, purposeless process, whereas, Keith, you presumably believe there is a purpose because there's a God behind the evolutionary process. And now Robert, for you, why does evolution have to have this kind of blind, purposeless kind of existence?
Well, it's a simpler idea, basically. If you see lots of small cornflakes at the bottom of a cornflakes packet, and you know that small flakes can fall through large gaps and large flakes can't fall through small gaps, and you see all the small flakes at the bottom of the packet, you know, it says on the packet, contents may have settled in transit. Now, you have they're a perfectly natural explanation for why the small flakes are at the bottom. And if a theistic evolutionist says, well, I know it looks like it's random. I know it looks like the flakes got there through random natural vibrations of the cornflakes packet and furthest falling of the smallest flake. But actually they got there because God put them there. Now, I can't disprove that, but it seems to me incredibly contrived. It's important to note that the kind of evolution Keith was talking about, as Keith said, they didn't have a scientific mechanism, and evolution meant change. Now, if you look at Darwinian evolution, it certainly means change, but if you look at the mechanism involved, it's a very wasteful mechanism. I don't know that it's one that those early idealists would have wanted to accept, as we can't really know, I suppose. I mean, you mentioned Erasmus Darwin. But he once described, he described some forms of Christianity as a featherbed for falling Christians. In other words, a way of getting them to sort of avoid the hard questions, providing a sort of easier way out. And I think that theistic evolution is, we might call it a featherbed for falling Christians, a sort of compromise.
Well, and you've sort of a forced place of retreat, which is
yes.
What I suggested earlier, but you would contend with that.
What Robert is suggesting there is that evolution looks random and haphazard and purposeless. I would contest that. I don't think it does. I think to anybody who looks dispassionately at the process of evolution from 13.7 billion years ago, a state of infinite mass and no variety, no complexity, no consciousness, no intelligence at all, through the eons of cosmic evolution to the development of life on Earth from very simple strands of DNA to the enormously complex DNA code that we now have to make up the most complex thing we know in the universe, the human brain, that looks as though it's directed towards the growth of intelligence. Even Richard Dawkins says this. It looks designed. It looks intelligently designed. Now, I will accept and put on one side for the moment that it doesn't look as though the designer cares very much about the happiness of the beings which are produced. It doesn't look like that. But it does look amazingly intelligent. Mm. So I contest that view, that it looks haphazard. I think it doesn't look haphazard.
First of all, I didn't say evolution was random. I said it's not purposeful. There's a big difference. Evolution contains a random element, namely mutations. Animals have variations that are slightly different from their parents. But the key to understanding evolution is that random variations can have consequences that are non-random for survival. For example, a polar bear, if a polar bear cub is born with black fur, you can make a pretty good guess what the implications of that are for survival. It's going to be less able to sneak up on the seals that it eats. It's going to be less likely to catch them. It's poorly camouflaged. It's not going to catch as much food. It's going to die younger or have fewer offspring. And the gene for black coats is not propagated. So evolution allows you to have the appearance, well, it allows you to have non-random outcomes without any intelligent designer being there to direct things. As for the appearance of fine-tuning to produce life or a universe capable of creating life, to give an example of how poor I think theology is, a poor way of understanding the world, let's imagine for a minute that the universe, the laws in the universe, are hostile to life. Any life, so hostile, life could never arise, and if it did arise, it would instantly get zapped by a bolt of lightning, let's say. I mean, that's a pretty hostile universe. Mm-hmm. Imagine that life existed in such a universe and did so only because God supernaturally shielded it from all these nasty laws. And now, theologians would point to this as sure evidence for the existence of God. They'd say, look, life is so poorly tuned to life, so the universe is so poorly tuned to the production of life, it's so hostile to the production of life, this proves that God exists. And they could square it with Christian theology by saying the need for God to intervene all the time and fight off these laws shows how much God cares for his creation. It shows he's actively involved in keeping us alive and sustaining our very being. Now, you contrast that with theistic evolution, which holds that God worked out the laws in advance but doesn't play a direct role anymore. The problem with theology is you can harmonize a world that is conducive to life with belief in God. You could harmonize a universe where the laws are incredibly hostile to life. You could come up with a good argument for God from that. You can come up with an argument for God based on any evidence whatsoever. And that's why, in my view, you can have no confidence in theology.
Hmm. Well, let's not class all theologians as a special sort of people with a special sort of brain that has crazy ideas. Let's just talk about people who are asking what the world is like. Let's talk about scientists. Forget theologians. If you look at scientists like Paul Davis or Martin Rees, the Astronomer Royal, or Freeman Dyson, or Henry Stapp, or John von Neumann, I mean, I'm just reeling off some Nobel Prize winners there. And you say, well, what? Never mind religion. Do they think there's a problem about what you have just called the fine-tuning of the universe? That is, that only if the law of gravity was exactly what it is could you have stars forming and carbon forming, and only if Planck's constant, all these fundamental constants in the laws of nature, only if they were exactly what they were would you have carbon-based life forms, which Star Trek tells us we are. So I just would say, do they have a problem about it? And the answer is yes, they have a problem. I'm not saying God is the answer to the problem. I'm saying, you know, as scientists, they have a problem. Why is the universe so fine-tuned to produce life? It was Freeman Dyson, a very, very good physicist, who said, well, it looks as though the universe knew that we were coming. Now, what he meant by that is the fundamental structure of atoms and subatomic particles, etc., seems to be just right to build up stable complexes of replicating DNA, etc. It looks as though it's been, well, it looks as though it's been fine-tuned, as you said. That is, as though somebody had tuned in a radio to get the exact program. Well, and there is a... So I'm not giving an answer to this, and I'm not bringing in God as the answer. I'm not doing that.
But there is a natural, you know, if you had to then go a step further and say, well, why does the universe look so designed, look so finely tuned? You would say it's God. And the problem you have with that, Robert, is yes. that, well, theologians would, you know, want it both ways. If it didn't look like a finely tuned universe, they'd say, well, isn't it amazing that God nevertheless has created us?
Yes, I mean...
Is that... So you think theology doesn't play fairly.
Yes, that's one problem. And another problem with the fine-tuning argument is if you say that if we assume that the laws of nature do look finely tuned, and religious people say, well, they're finely tuned because God was there sort of twiddling the knob on the radio and finally tuning everything, they assume that God exists and that God is a sort of fine tuner. Now, atheists start with a simpler assumption that a finely tuned universe exists. Atheists offer a simpler starting assumption. You know, the theist's starting assumption is an incredibly complicated tuner creating a less complicated tuned universe. Now, atheists just dispense with the former and stay with the latter. It's simpler, and it's therefore to be preferred by scientific principles, which state that you shouldn't posit more phenomena than you've got the evidence for. If you hear clip-clopping of hooves down the London street, as Richard Dawkins once said, it might be unicorns, but before we believe it's anything other than horses, we should demand a large amount of evidence. And if you're going to bring in something, an idea like God, an idea so different to everything we know in the universe, a supernatural idea, someone who's infinitely wise, you know, it requires a huge amount of evidence before these things can reasonably be believed.
OK, can I take...
Before you respond, and now you're desperate to there, Keith, let me say that if you're listening and you're hearing anything that Keith or Robert is saying that's prompting you to want to respond, you can do that via the usual methods. The email address is unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and the phone line, if you'd like to leave a voicemail message, is 08456 52 52 52. And select option 5.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
I think we're going to extend this discussion on the evolution, because I feel like we've only really grazed the surface of the stuff, and so I feel like the whole programme could probably be given over to it in this sense, but that's not to say we won't perhaps address the other question that we were looking at earlier at another point in time. But, I mean, everything that Robert is saying there, Keith, is that basically, for him, anyone who postulates God on top of the universe we can see around us and that we deduce scientifically is just kind of adding extra complication. Can't we just say this is what it is? That's enough. We don't have to say that it was a very complex thing that then created a slightly less complex universe, etc.
I think that's a pretty unscientific thing to say, because a scientist, I think, will never be satisfied with saying that's just the way it is. Don't ask any further. It's just, you know, there it is, pretty simple. First of all, it's not pretty simple. It's extraordinarily complex. And if you try to say what the universe is made of and you get down to superstrings in 11 dimensions and you say that's simple, then I don't know what sense of simple you have in mind. It's beyond me. So I doubt whether this universe is simple. You know, 95% of it is dark energy, dark matter. It gets more and more complicated the more you think about it. So that principle of Occam's razor, which is don't multiply entities unnecessarily.
Use the simplest explanation.
That word simple, you see, it can be used in lots of different ways. But if by simple you mean have as few entities as you can think of, right, I don't think that's a very good scientific principle. I think actually in subatomic physics you couldn't get away with that. I mean, you'd have to say, I'm sorry, there is what physicists call a particle zoo, and we're not going to get down to something simple. So you may find you're just stuck with something rather complex, right? So simplicity, I want to question the supposition that the simpler you get, the more likely things are to be that way. I think that's quite false, and I think actually, as between simplicity and complexity, I would expect things to be rather complex, if anything. So I just find that a very odd argument, and a piece of philosophy that's not necessary to say, you know, the universe must in the end be rather simple, and then you just got to put up with it. And all the physicists I know would say, well, you may just have to put up with it. Yes, I'm not denying that. But it's not good. If we could find an expression, and that's why today, we're moving on from evolution a little bit here, but that's why today a lot of physicists are taking seriously the multiverse hypothesis, which is, well, we have to explain why this universe looks fine-tuned in the way that it is. We could do that by positing lots and lots of universes, which breaks the principle of simplicity completely. But it's a very fashionable thing for scientists to say.
But in essence, it has no more evidential basis as to suggest, well, it was God.
Well, there is this difference, Justin, that God is not a scientific hypothesis, okay? And I think underlying this discussion, there's a sort of, I think you, Robert, are assuming that God's a sort of scientific hypothesis, which will help your science, and without which perhaps you can't do your science. And I utterly reject that. God is not a scientific hypothesis. So physicists, strictly speaking, don't want to talk about God as physicists. You would rather find something else. So fine-tuning needs to be explained. I don't think anybody's got much idea how you do it, but it needs some explanation. Now, I would just say here, maybe a non-scientific explanation is on the cards. That is to say, if there is an intelligent creator, that's not scientific because you can't test that, you can't make predictions about what God might do, you can't measure God's actions, none of that. But it's still, what would it be? It wouldn't be simpler. It would be more elegant to say there is one creator who envisages a universe of living, intelligent, relatively free, loving, possibly, beings, and sets up one universe, not 20 million or 10 to the power of 500, which some cosmologists say, universes. So you have one universe which will actually produce such life forms. That sounds an elegant hypothesis, but it's a hypothesis, it's a theory in philosophy. It's not scientifically testable. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I mean, there are some things that are not scientifically testable.
We'll come back in just a short moment. We've run out of time on this section, but in a short moment we'll be back with my guests here in the studio, Keith Ward, Oxford professor and philosopher and Christian as well, and Robert Stovold, an atheist scientist with a background in evolution and biology, as we continue to discuss this area and perhaps get back onto the subject of evolution and creation and how we can, believe in both and why Robert says that's simply not possible and why Keith has written a book claiming that it is. Hello, welcome back to the programme. Well, Karl Marx said some time back that religion is the opium of the masses. He certainly didn't see God as playing any part in the Marxist ideals that he so famously brought about. Well, we're going to be having a Marxist on the programme next week. Jack Conrad is going to be our comrade here in the studio. Jonathan Bartley will be our Christian, and Jonathan will be in conversation with Jack about why he believes Jesus, not Karl Marx, is the answer to the problems of the world today. So that's going to be a fascinating interaction between communism and Christianity. That's at the same time, between 2:30 and 4 o'clock next week.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
And we continue to discuss evolution and creation. Can we believe in evolution with all its wastefulness, with all, if you like, the things that entails, as well as a benign creator God? We've had some fascinating discussion already in this area, and Keith Ward is with us, whose book, The Big Questions in Science and Religion, asks us to consider that, yes, we can believe in a creator behind, if you like, that evolutionary process. Now, already, Robert, I know, has been telling us that why posit something, why can't we just take evolution as it stands? Why do we have to throw God in behind it, if you like? Because I suppose for you, Robert, evolution is a beautifully elegant way of explaining the way that life has come about on Earth. And in a sense, almost to say that, well, God set it in motion is almost to do an injustice to such a beautiful self-fulfilling kind of process.
It's elegant in the sense that it's simple. It's not elegant in the sense that it works. It's got a random element to it, throwing off mutations in all kinds of directions and exterminating the vast majority of individuals bearing those mutations which don't work out. But I think one way we measure the value of something or the wonder of something is by how easy it is to achieve. For example, if I was running against you in a race and we both crossed the line at the same time, which one of us would be the better athlete? Well, there's nowhere to say because we both crossed the line at the same time. But suppose I told you that, suppose we discovered that I had one leg and you had two. Well, I'd obviously be the better athlete because although I wasn't faster, I did as much as you did, but I only had one leg. Now, to me, atheism offers a much more wonderful way of looking at the world than does theism, because atheism does it all without God. Now, the trouble is, I think that theistic evolutionists want to have it both ways. On the one hand, they say, isn't God wonderful? He gets everything back down to basic, simple physical principles. So they'll sort of float simplicity as being a good thing, a hallmark of, a sort of wonderful way of design. And then they'll go back and posit something very complicated again, God producing all these laws. And it's a much more wonderful way of doing things, just to keep it simple.
So, Keith, maybe it would be good if you explained then why you believe that, if you like, having God behind the process, being the one who, if you like, set this evolutionary process or had it in mind in some way, why that to you is a good thing rather than just an addition you had to make because you have a Christian faith. I mean, that's the way I think Robert probably sees it, is that Christians who are theistic evolutionists just take the science and then have to add God in because that's part of their faith belief, and it doesn't in any way, it's in no way does evolution necessitate that there's a God happening. It's just that the people who believe in God have to put God in as well because they're kind of obliged to.
Well, I don't actually disagree with that because I used to be an atheist. I mean, I could accept the theory of evolution without God in a flash. There are lots of problems that would remain. I think fine-tuning is a big problem that needs some sort of explanation, but you don't need to have God. You can think of other ways of doing that. But belief in God does come first. And that's a very important, not scientific, but philosophical part, because what I mean by that is a believer in God thinks the ultimately real thing about the universe is consciousness, is mind, is intelligence. Now, if you're the sort of evolutionist who says, evolution goes along and it throws up consciousness as a byproduct, it's not even necessary, it certainly comes very late in the day and it doesn't really have any part really to play, and a hardline materialist might say, but it's not even there, it's just nothing but the brain.
And when we talk about consciousness, we're talking about, I suppose, the thing that makes us human, really, the fact that we are self-aware, that we... if you like, can reflect on the world and the things around
us. This is why I became a believer in God, is because of the problem, not of evolution, but the problem of consciousness. It's bound up with evolution because, of course, human consciousness does evolve. Nobody's denying that. But when you ask what is consciousness, is it something more than the material bits which make up the brain? It just seems to me the answer is, well, to me, it's obviously yes, it is something more. And then, so there's a huge problem, if you think that, as to consciousness is.
Given that you do believe that at some point in the evolutionary process, consciousness came about, is it your belief then that, if you like, there was a divine spark, that was the point that God touched the evolutionary process and something happened?
Oh, what I'm really saying is more amazing than that. But it's what most philosophers in the history of the Western tradition actually have believed, and that is that matter cannot exist without consciousness. Material things actually only take the form they do when they are contents of some consciousness. Now, that might sound amazing. So consciousness comes first. But in fact, lots of quantum physicists take that view, that the reality as we perceive it now can only exist in that form for some consciousness. So what I'm saying, what I'm saying is, ultimately, consciousness is the one true reality. So it's not that I'm adding God, you see, onto an evolutionary theory. It's that for me, God is the only real thing there is. And the question about evolution is, how does the material world get generated from God?
Now, these are obviously quite deep philosophical points, which you're trying to expand in a very short way. But so ultimately, though, you're saying God, if you like, is the ultimate consciousness.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Before human consciousness perhaps ever came to be,
or before anything came to be,
there had to be something for materialism to actually, you know, exist in, and it had to be the conscious mind of God, if you like.
I believe that as a philosophical point of view, I've come to think, and one of my philosophy teachers in Oxford, Fred Eyre, although he was an atheist, believed the same thing. And most philosophers have believed that. So if you don't believe that, it's a huge change in the way you see the world. And it's not science that brings about that change. That's my point.
The problem is that for people like Robert and perhaps Richard Dawkins, who aren't particularly interested maybe in philosophy, as far as they're concerned, it's about the science, it's about what we can know and experiment and test on. That sort of stuff isn't really relevant. Have you ever thought of bringing in these philosophical aspects to what you believe about the world and that sort of thing, Robert?
Well, philosophy isn't just sort of limited to people in ivory towers. Common sense relates to philosophy. It's a kind of, I think, and a scientific way of looking at the world is a kind of philosophy as well. Philosophy is just about thinking, which everybody does. Everyone's got their own philosophy, although they may not know enough about the study of philosophy to give it a name. So I do care about philosophy. I wouldn't say that I know that much about it, not being a philosopher by training. But I think that I hear some philosophers and think they're a load of rubbish, and I hear others and think, oh, that sounds quite promising. So I do take an interest in it.
What do you say to this idea that the fact that it's possible for people to reflect and think about themselves, consciousness, and Keith's contention that this isn't just an accidental byproduct of the evolutionary process, it's actually integral to, you know, the very fact that there is a world. Mm. Does that kind of persuade you in any way?
I don't see why consciousness should be such a hard problem. I mean, if you think of most animals as knowing things, what I mean by that is sensing things and responding to stimuli in just the same way that, say, a robot would sense things, sense a wall when it bumps into it or something like that. If you think of that kind of thing as being able to evolve, then why can't knowing that you know evolve? It's just a little extra feedback loop that gets put in there. If you can know things, why can't you? You could make a point that it's even easier to detect your own internal state than it is to detect something in the external world, because the internal world's, well, part of your brain and the external world isn't. I don't see why consciousness should be such a hard problem.
And so for you, there's absolutely no need to go beyond the material facts of what we are. I mean, ultimately for you, human beings are, when you boil it down, just a lot of atoms and electrical charges whizzing around in certain ways that make us believe that we are seeing things, believing things, that we love people, that we you know, have desires and intentions. It ultimately all boils down to molecules and electrons passing around, and there's nothing more than that. That is, well, a strictly, if you like, what we might term materialist view.
That's what's known as nothing buttery. Just the idea that just because you can explain something in certain terms, it's nothing but those terms. Now, if you were to look at my brain in a sort of mechanical scientific way and say, well, what exactly happens there? Let's sort of analyse all the processes that go on. You might, if you were a clever scientist, be able to come up with a complete understanding of the way my brain works. But there'd be more to it than that, because you'd need to take into consideration the way my brain got to be, all the evolutionary selective pressures that have been acting on human beings over the years, and before that, different animals. So you can't just, when you're trying to understand something, you can't just look at the sort of machinery, if you like. You have to also look at the product that gave rise to it. People aren't just a product of genes. They're a product of genes that happened to work, that survived. You know, they're products of successful ancestors. There's a meaningful correspondence between the genes that give rise to us and the environment. They're there because they did well. So life isn't without, how can I put it, it's not arbitrary. It corresponds to the environment. It's fitted to the environment. So I don't think that the lack of some divine purpose giver means that we don't sort of fit in, if you see what I mean.
Hmm. Well, I think this is the heart of the problem, really. I mean, believers in God do not think there's a material world. And in addition, we've got this other complicated thing, God. We do not think that. I don't think that. I think there is God, the supreme mind, knowing creating and enjoying a universe, perhaps. Mm-hmm. So that's the ultimate reality. And there couldn't be any physical reality at all without that. And I think that's just a position that maybe some people have forgotten or lost or rejected and just said, no, the physical can exist on its own. There's no problem about that. So I think that's where the debate really goes down to. I would seriously say I do not think any physical thing can exist on its own. I think that it has to be a content of consciousness. And, of course, so then the argument would shift away from evolution. But if you say that, then if that's where you're starting from, then you see the evolutionary process as a way in which consciousness is producing something different, in which I would think a supreme consciousness, God, is producing other finite consciousnesses which can share something of the life of God. So from a Christian point of view, you know, the evolutionary system fits in with that view of God, the supreme consciousness, creating other consciousness to share its life. So that's how it would go. It's not that you look at the material world and you say, oh, but there might be an extra bit. That's not the way you look at it. You have to start from a very different position, that mind is the ultimate reality.
Well, I think one problem with doing that is you assume that God's, or you're able to assume as a theologian anyway, that God's mind moves in mysterious ways. And once you do that, you don't really have a basis for understanding anything, because if it chimes in with what you personally think, your own intuition, you can say, oh, yes, that's the way a mind would work. And if you find something that doesn't chime in with your own intuition, you can say, oh, well, who am I to argue with the way God would do things? And you can still come up with an explanation that works. So explaining things in terms of the mind is a very, very risky strategy. It's far better to explain things in terms of what you can directly observe, the physical world.
But isn't the whole point that you can only observe the physical world because you're doing it with a mind, and that you're ultimately you're bound to your consciousness to even make any assumptions about the physical world?
Well, I would say that you're sort of drawing a distinction between the mind and the physical world there. Now, if what we label as the mind corresponds to physical activity in the brain, I'm saying things have a physical basis. So the mind is compatible with that, if you define the mind as physical activity in the brain.
Well, if you do, but that's yes. Precisely the point of the issue. I mean, I suppose religious people would rather use the word spirit than mind, but I'm using it the same way. The basic reality is spiritual. It's not material. And the material world, the 4 or perhaps 11-dimensional world we live in, is an expression of a spiritual reality. I mean, I think that has to be the religious view. And so you've got to tackle it at that level. And if you say, well, I'm just going to define the mind as physical activity in the brain, well, okay, you've just got a different view of what the world is like.
But it's a simpler view.
I think it's an incoherent view, actually, and I would call in aid quite a lot of interpretations of quantum physics, but maybe we can't go into that as well.
Well, just before we go any further, let me give people a chance to get in touch. If you're listening to anything today, something sparked your interest, you want to respond to something someone has said, then do get in touch via the usual methods, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or phone in your voicemail comment 08456 52 52 52 and select option 5. As I've said, there are a wide variety of views within Christianity on the whole evolution and creation discussion. Obviously, Keith here in the studio represents a theistic evolutionary point of view, that there he believes, happy to believe in evolution, but believes that there is a creator God going on behind the scenes. Oh, I know many of my listeners will not agree with that, and you're welcome to send your views in. Do get in touch by the usual method here on Unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Going back to your original point, which is why, I mean, presumably, why did God have to use this very convoluted process to get consciousness?
Yes,
out
I mean,
of,
if you believe
the, out of it,
I suppose it depends on where you are. If you're what, Trinitarian,
what's the point then? I suppose, and this is the point that many Christians who don't believe in evolution would also have in common with Robert, in a way, Keith. What's the point of going through such a very long and arduous process over millions of years to get something which God could have created? Flash, yeah. Like that, as is actually described in the book of Genesis.
I accept that God could have done that. The philosopher Bertrand Russell used to say, actually, the whole world could have come into existence 5 seconds ago. That's possible, mm-hmm. even without
yeah.
God.
Yeah.
But, of course, if it did, we would have a lot of false beliefs, a lot of false memories. We would have a lot of false history. And we're the sorts of beings who have a long historical and evolutionary past. Now, I accept that that's true. That's what we are. Mm. So if you ask what sort of beings are we, I would accept that we are emergent, evolutionary produced beings, and that we can only understand our present nature by understanding our evolutionary past. We can only understand why we're lustful and aggressive, for example, by understanding the conditions which have led us to become the dominant species on the planet. So you look at natural selection and what's likely to have happened. So it's a very good explanation of why we're the mixture of things that we are. And if the bottom line is this: if we humans are going to be the integral parts of the physical universe that we are, then the process of evolution is the process of a material reality becoming spiritualized, becoming conscious, becoming intelligent, becoming free. And we're not the last part, but a very interesting phase of this development.
Can you hazard a guess as to why God would use evolution as the model for doing that, as opposed to any other way of producing consciousness?
Now, this is speculation, because, of course, the Bible says nothing about this, and Christian theologians of old times didn't really think about evolution. But from a strictly scientific point of view, accepting that evolution is a process that happened, I think there is a certain sublimity and beauty about the gradual emergence of complexity, organization, and consciousness out of a material substructure. And I find that totally awe-inspiring.
Does it pose, and I know when I've spoken to people who do hold to a strictly creationist account, one of the problems they have is that it throws up possible problems for Christian theology over things like original sin, or, you know, if we're talking about the fall, you know, which is pictured in Genesis as Adam and Eve being excluded from the garden because they sin. You can't sort of have that account in evolution, because it's such, you know, at some point, if you're saying humans evolved and became conscious, or you know, it's very hard to pinpoint, you know, there was a first Adam and Eve or something. I mean, how would you go about reconciling those kinds of aspects of Christian theology with the evolutionary
account? Well, again, I would just say that Genesis account is a symbolic account. It's an account of how human being, I mean, the existentialist philosophers have put it very well, I think, that what Genesis is talking about is the estrangement of human beings from knowledge of God and love of God. I should point out, of course, that not all Christians believe in original sin.
No, indeed.
None of the Eastern Orthodox churches believe in original sin, and so it's a purely Western phenomenon, which comes from Augustine. But you might want to say, and again, I don't think you have to be religious to say this, there must have been a time at which the first moral awareness appeared on the planet Earth. And you might want to say that with that growth of moral awareness came a sense of being unable to do what was right. I mean, a sense of guilt or a sense of inadequacy. So you can give an evolutionary account of the development of morality, and people are trying to do that with a certain amount of success. But I should say, of course, the growth of morality is another big problem for evolutionary biology. You might want to say we could, in principle, come to an account of how morality developed, but nobody is agreed about exactly what that process is. So in evolution, which I accept the scientific account of evolution, I see the problem of consciousness, the development of consciousness, the problem of the development of morality, and the development of a sense of God, which people like me claim to have, as big problems. That's not to say they have no solution, but to say evolution is not a theory which is all settled and we know what it is and there are no problems. And I'm focusing on the problems and saying, well, you know, there are a number of open alternatives for these problems. And I think God's a good hypothesis.
Now, here we see we're getting into what's called the God of the gaps. Science can't explain it yet, so God must be the explanation. So what happens here? If science finds an explanation, Keith will say, well, that's all right, because God put the scientific laws in place.
Don't tell me what I'd say, Robert.
Well, that's exactly what you are saying for things like natural selection.
No, I'm not saying I'm bringing God into a gap. I completely deny the idea of the God of the gaps. The expression, of course, was invented by a Methodist scientist.
but you said there are problems in evolutionary biology and God is a good hypothesis for answering them.
God is not a scientific hypothesis.
Well, is he an explanation?
Yes, I think there can be philosophical explanations, but now it's a different sense of explanation. I think what's going on here is that you're limiting explanations to the sorts of things that evolutionary biologists can come up with. I'm all for those explanations, but I don't think they provide ultimate answers to the question, why is the universe the way it is?
I'm afraid we're running out of time, gentlemen, and it's been a fascinating programme. And I'm sorry to cut you short there, because there are obviously many more things that could be said. But we're going to have to draw it to a close. So thank you so much for the time that we've spent talking about these things. If you're listening, and again, let me give you the title of the book that Keith has written, The Big Questions in Science and Religion, by Keith Ward, published by Templeton Press. And if you'd like to go to the Premier website, that's the easy way to get hold of it, at premier.org.uk/shop. Now, I know there are many differing views out there among our audience as to creation and who was responsible and how it happened. And so obviously today, Keith very much representing the beliefs of a theistic evolutionist. And we want to thank you, Keith, for coming in and giving your wisdom on this topic, and Robert as well, for being with us as well.
Thank you.
On the programme today. If you'd like to get in touch, again, the email address unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and the phone number 08456 52 52 52. But it's not goodbye, because these two guests are going to be joining me again in August, as Keith is coming on to talk about a book that will be published then. It's a response, if you like, to Richard Dawkins and the God Delusion, and it's titled Why There Almost Certainly Is a God. So expect more of this sort of debate, and we'll be specifically looking at the problems Richard Dawkins has with God in that particular debate. That's coming up in August. But until then, we'll have to say goodbye, gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming in, Robert. I hope you enjoyed the discussion today.
Yes, very much. Thank you.
Good. And Keith, thank you for the time.
Thank you, Justin.
You've been listening to Unbelievable. That debate today on evolution and belief in a creator God, are they compatible? And as I say, do get in touch and do visit online to listen back to this programme. That's premier.org.uk/unbelievable. You're unbelievable. Well, do join us again, as I'm joined by Jack Conrad. He is a communist, and he's going to be telling us why he believes Marxism and the communist way is the way forward for society. We're asking, who will save the world, Marx or Jesus Christ? The man who believes it's Jesus Christ is Jonathan Bartley from Ecclesia. He's going to be with us next week as we look at this question. I don't know if you've ever met a sort of fervent Marxist communist. Well, that's certainly the way Jack sees the world. And he says there's no need for belief in God in the future, if you like, which he believes is communism. Do join us again at the same time next week, 2:30 till 4 o'clock here on Unbelievable, and online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.